Essentially, like Shreese said in his introduction, this type of problem, the physics, is reasonably well understood. So you can argue with me at the end whether it's applicable to AXPs or not, but I think we can agree at least going through the problem is quite well understood. First, I'm just going to talk about the regimes of magnetic fields, just kind of introductory. Talk about why we expect, why the thermal conduction in a strong magnetic field is different than in a weak magnetic field. It turns out to be not as different as one would hope, but there's some other things that help us along. There's some complications that come in. Magnetic field decay, which has been touted a lot recently, and I'll maybe describe a reason why this might not be terribly, well, it's not terribly a strong effect compared to changing the envelope. I'll present some cooling curves and then describe, well, this is great theory, but what actually do we observe and how can we actually compare this with what we're talking about that we actually see. And unlike a regular debate, I'm just going to give a great segue to the next speaker, so instead of making it hard. That was unplanned. Magnetic field regimes, we go from sort of millisecond pulsar or at least my favorite types of white dwarfs, which I've done work on, up near a gigabit Gauss field. You have atomic processes perturbed and anisotropic heat transport, and I'll describe why that happens. Then you're sort of garden variety, what we think of radio pulsars. The heat transport is quantized near the surface. The atoms are magnetically distorted, so you have to consider that when doing a model of the atmosphere. As you go to stronger fields, QED becomes important. The atoms are literally one-dimensional, which is a great simplification. And you have quantized transport in the zone of the crust that's most important in determining the flux. So from this regime onwards, you expect to see a change in the flux, even along the field direction, due to the magnetic field. And as you go to stronger fields yet, only a few lambda levels are filled throughout the envelope, which is a nice simplification because it allows you to do everything analytically, or almost analytically. Heat conduction is strongly affected by an intense magnetic field. The classical effect is, since you compare the ratio of the cyclotron time to the scattering time, and if the time between scatterings is much longer than the time for an electron to loop around the field, you expect the field, instead of the electron going like this and then going like this, it spends this all time going around in a circle. So you don't get much conduction of heat in the opposite direction. So this, if you see this cross conduction, all it's the ratio is the cyclotron frequency times the scattering time. There's no real quantum mechanics in the traditional sense what happens there. There's more parallel conduction if it feels sufficiently strong, and I'll describe why. And the sources of opacity are kind of represented in this picture. This represents the field. And these are our electrons zipping about, and they like to go around the field. They don't like to cross the field lines. You can have impurities in a crystal lattice that they'll distort, that will just scatter the electrons as if they were just charged particles in a liquid. Or you can have particles that are in the wrong spot, like this one, which is a phonon that it scatters off of. And these are the two important scattering mechanisms in the solid state. However, the most important opacity source is actually where the crust is liquid, and there it's just scattering off of ions. And in principle, you could imagine the field being inhomogeneous, so the heat just never gets to the surface. But the inhomogeneity has to be on order of several tens or hundreds of meters, which is kind of hard to put in when you think of the whole neutron star being several, around 10 kilometers in radius. So the reason, this is a rather complicated diagram, if you think about like an electron traveling around without a magnetic field through this material, the material is degenerate. So when the electron scatters, it can only find another place for itself within kT of the top of the Fermi C. So what that what happens there is, you know, an electron could be going this way, let's say. So this, I'm just representing the momentum, and it can scatter and be over here and over there. And sort of the length of the stick is constant from scattering to scattering, because they all, it can only change by kT. There's no place for them to go. So, however, the phase space that an electron lives in a strong magnetic field is rather complicated. I mean, that I could just represent by my stick on a sphere. This kind of represents what's happening. I mean, it actually gives numerically the right answers. And what you have happening is going up in this diagonal, these diagonal lines represent higher and higher Fermi momentum, meaning the Fermi energy squared minus the mass squared. And as you, at low Fermi momentum, you can only fill up one level. So when this electron who's sitting here wants to scatter, it just has one choice. It can kind of scatter into a state with nearly the same momentum, which isn't going to really affect the cooling, or it can scatter around in the opposite direction. It's a one-dimensional problem. And if you were to imagine these lines being equally spaced, as you increased the Fermi momentum, you could see that the gas, after it starts filling up many levels, it starts acting two-dimensional, in a sense, because the amount of phase space is just the length on these black lines. However, what really happens is the levels get closer and closer together. So as you increase the Fermi momentum, so as you go deeper into the crust of the star, for a given magnetic field, the gas starts behaving closer to three-dimensional. When you have a one-dimensional gas, I made the point that the electron has nowhere to go, really, after it scatters. So it just doesn't scatter. So it just travels along unimpeded for a much larger distance through the crust. If it becomes acts like a two-dimensional gas, you can imagine it has a little more breathing room. And finally, in a three-dimensional situation, we just recover the non-magnetic field case. So you expect the flux to increase as you increase the strength of the magnetic field. A second great simplifying property of this is that the conduction across the field, as long as the field is above, you know, maybe 10 to the 12 Gauss, is negligible. It's much, much smaller than the conduction along the field. So it's really only important right near the magnetic equator of the star. The envelope is extremely thin. The sensitivity zone, the region that actually is providing most of this opacity, is only a few hundred meters thick, while the radius of the star is 100 times as large. This allows one to do the calculation in a plain parallel manner, plus it allows you to throw away any GR effects except on the global structure of the field. You don't have to worry about the change in, let's say, the gravitational redshift from the top to the bottom of this crustal region. And for strong fields, what one attains is that the flux for a given core temperature increases not terribly quickly with the magnetic field strength. This sort of law starts maybe 10 to the 13 Gauss and higher when you're in that quantized regime. And it drops down as the cosine squared of the angle with respect to the field and the normal. So that's just due to this first effect up there. So we've heard a bit of discussion today about the decay of the magnetic field. Martin made the point that, you know, the field itself may be a source of energy, and the primary source of energy for this neutron star. There's been calculations done by Goldreich, Reisnecker, and also Thompson Duncan proposed this a bit later, that for a strongly magnetized neutron star, ambipolar diffusion may cause the field to decay. And, you know, the neutron star is filled with a plasma, but it's mostly neutral. So it is an area where you expect ambipolar diffusion to occur, just like in a protostar. And the time scales are quite large, unless the field gets quite large or the temperature is quite large. And what you can have happening is for fields around 10 to the 16 Gauss and hot temperatures, you can get the field decay to happen on orders of thousands of years. However, one doesn't know where this field energy ends up, which is a problem. You can say, well, the field energy gets dumped below this sensitivity region in the core of the neutron star. Then, since the neutron star is young, it's several hundred million degrees in the core, that field decay energy just goes away. It just disappears as neutrinos. That's the easiest way for it to go. So it won't really help you terribly much, but this, I feel, is the most reasonable place for it to go. For this reason, well, it could go in the magnetosphere, which is also a large region of space. However, there, how is it going to become thermal flux unless it couples back to the top of the neutron star in some way? And it could get dumped in the envelope somewhere, so it would actually escape as photons on the surface eventually. There could have a really strong effect. However, it would be a wild coincidence that you're dumping 100% of the decay energy in a fraction of 10 to the sixth of the mass of the star, which is that of the envelope. So a second complication, which is a much stronger complication, I would argue, is if the envelope consists of light elements. So essentially, if you expect some fallback on the supernova, you're going to pile up material on the neutron star, and for it to populate for the entire envelope, which isn't the crust of the neutron star, it's a thin layer at the top of the crust, maybe 100 meters thick to a kilometer thick, you don't need very much material to affect the flux from the star. You need an order of an Earth mass to fall back, which astrophysically isn't terribly large. And what one sees here is, given the log of the age of the star in years, this is the luminosity, the log of the luminosity in ergs per second. This is for an iron envelope, and then up here is for hydrogen, which is a bit artificial, but it's sort of the largest you can imagine effect. And a bit below that lies the helium curve. So by changing the envelope, one can increase the luminosity at a given age by a factor of 10. So if one puts this all together into a cooling curve, this is just looking at magnetic field decay, you can see that if you take a 10 to the 16 Gauss star, quite a strong magnetic field, the field decay can increase the effective temperature by a large amount. However, if you look at more reasonable fields, the decay is too gentle at 10 to the 15 Gauss to really play an important role until late in the star's life. Now, one thing, there's been a lot of discussion about the happenstance that the periods of the AXPs are kind of clustered. And one can look at this plot and argue why you wouldn't tend to find some with, let's say, much larger periods, but with the same sort of characteristic P dots and stuff. It's simply because they disappear. You know, after a few hundred thousand years, you're not going to see them anymore, unless you have this decay mode here, which the reason this works is so well is it's adding heat to the core of the star after neutrino emissivity has dropped because the core temperature has gotten lower. So it can be a very important effect. So an important point to make is we are unable to measure the bolometric flux from the surface of the neutron star. We don't design instruments to do that. plus the ISM is in the way, and essentially, as Martin was mentioning, you know, maybe 99% of the flux is stuck in the extreme UV that we'll never see. But on the before it leaves the vicinity of the neutron star, it's processed to an atmosphere, which also has an extremely important effect. We also don't really know the distance to these isolated neutron stars very well, to within a factor of two, except for these two famous objects. People have argued that the pulse fraction might be a model-dependent thing, and something really as a way to say, you can't argue that the pulse fraction would be this high in a magnetar model. But when one looks, actually measures pulse fraction, you're measuring it through this colored region, effectively, of the atmosphere plus the ISM, which is going to bias your pulse fraction up to higher energies. Okay? And if you think of a black body, you can vary the temperature by a little bit. But if you're looking in the Wien tail of the black body, the flux will vary by a whole lot. Plus, the atmosphere tends to beam the radiation in the normal direction. So when you actually look at one of these AXPs, you're not looking at the whole surface of the star. You're looking at the regions where the magnetic field or the normal happens to point towards you. So, and these regions also happen to be hotter. So if they pop in and out of view, you can really get a large pulse fraction, much larger than you would expect by just adding up a black body over the whole surface of the star. So I'll just leave us up on this slide. But essentially, I would argue that our understanding of the actual cooling, the total flux, is well understood modulo dumping extra energy in there by field decay, for example. But to really go a long way with what we are actually observing, we really need to understand the atmospheres. It's very difficult to come up with quantities that we can observe that don't depend on the properties of the atmosphere. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thanks, Jeremy. Any questions? Yes.
Oh, well, that's kind of a leading question. What can you say about polarization given this? Well, the polarization, you expect the emission from these atmospheres to be polarized. There's been work by George Pavlov. There's currently work that Don Lloyd is doing. Then what is a bit problematic and something that I've been working on and George worked on is how this polarization gets propagated through the magnetosphere. And then what is the net polarization you observe from the star? And there's kind of two ways of looking at it. You can say, well, when you look at a neutron star, you're going to see half of its surface, or maybe even more if it's more, you know, you're going to see more than half because it's compact. So you have to add up the polarization vectors from all these areas on the star, and they're going to cancel out to a large extent. And this was the result of a paper by George and Zaplin, right? However, even in a moderately magnetized neutron star, even in a millisecond pulsar, when X-rays leave the surface of the star, their modes, their propagating modes, are decoupled by the magnetic field, meaning that if I'm traveling, if I initially am a photon born with my polarization direction perpendicular to the field, no matter what twists and turns the field takes, and I take on the way out, my polarization direction will remain perpendicular to the field. So in that case, what you get is you can get a much larger polarization measurement. just like there's a result, well, now it turns on, of Mal did for explaining, Mal Ruderman explaining the high polarization radio pulsars. You wouldn't expect it to be so high because you can average over many disparate regions of magnetic field. However, in that case, the plasma decouples the polarization modes. So that's called in radio pulsars, it's the polarization limiting radius. The polarization limiting radius in these neutron stars in the X-rays is much larger than the radius of the neutron star itself. So you can get a lot of polarization out. But that isn't terribly, that depends mostly on the atmospheres, because for all the X-rays, as long as you have a field larger than 10 to the 9 Gauss, these modes, the polarization limiting radius is large. In the optical, however, it's a different point. There it would depend on the field more sensitively.
Any other questions? Yes.
Robin. Yeah. Yeah.
And we also found the atmospheres when we did the heavy element atmosphere. The polarization structure varies an awful lot as you go to the bottom of the atmosphere. Yeah, I mean, there is a net polarization. I mean, that's being so there's going to be some, but it's pretty complicated as you go through all the different spectral features of the atmosphere.
Yeah, I mean, when you go to like an iron atmosphere, the picture, you have so much potential information out there that, you know, polarization is probably not something you want to rely on. However, with hydrogen or a helium atmosphere, there's a paucity of information, so you grasp at straws, as it were, and polarization. I mean, it's an extremely difficult prospect measuring the polarization in the X-rays. It hasn't been done often, mainly not because it's technically impossible. It's probably less difficult than making a high-resolution X-ray spectrometer, and we've done that twice. Well, we've done it three times, but one ended up in the ocean. However, it's the motivation behind it isn't there so much. Like, why do we need to do this? However, with light element atmospheres, it appears to be important. You know, you get a nice net polarization. I could bring up the plot from George's paper, and you can, I mean, it's a detectable level, even if you average over the entire surface of the star, which I would argue you don't. You actually get to accumulate a lot of net polarization and get to sum everything up coherently rather than incoherently. Are there any other? Yuri?
Yes.
Jeremy, do you have anything to say about the non-thermal components?
No. I have no idea.
I mean, non-thermal component.
What do I have anything to say about the non-thermal component of the AXP emission? And the only place it could be connected with is the magnetosphere, and I haven't thought about those issues. What? I'm wise not to take on the tough problems.
Any other questions? Yes, over.
Yes. No. What I'm saying is, there's the impression that there's no motivation to doing it. That's why I'm doing it, to change that impression. I think I either misspoke or was misinterpreted. One or the other. Yes, exactly. I'm waffling. But I would argue, if one is just measuring, let's say, the net polarization without a phase resolution, a lot of this information, you can get a lot of information looking at the optical polarization from these guys. It's always coming on and off. However, that possibly is an equally difficult task, because if you notice, you know, the magnitudes are in the mid to upper 20s, and that's a difficult prospect measuring this polarization to good accuracy.
Okay, I think we better break now until 11. So thanks very much.
Yeah, no.
Not 11.